So far in our study, we've been talking about the context for the birth of Christianity. That in Galatians 4:4, when Paul said that when the certain time came, that when the fullness of the time came, that God sent forth his Son, there's a historical setting there, which is the whole purpose of this particular study. We've been looking at the history of the intertestamental period, the period leading up to the New Testament, to the beginning with Matthew. We've been looking at that and talking about the history. We've now been turning and talking about the religion. We talk about religion as Greco-Roman because we talk about the Greek and the Roman period, because the period when Christianity began was really right in the prime of the Greek and the Roman culture. The Greeks began way back in BC, their conquest of the world, and of course with the advent of Alexander the Great, he took Hellenism all around the world, and then at a certain point, as the world kingdoms come and go, we find that the Roman world begins to arise, passing from a republic to a dictatorship, to an emperorship. And so we're studying in that period right now. We've been talking so far up to this point about Judaism, and then getting into talking more about the beginning of the Roman Empire, and we'll say more about that as we continue with religion. When you look at the culture of a society, if you ever take a course in anthropology or any kind of historical course, you'll find out there's certain things that really make a culture a culture. And we often ask the question, what exactly do you mean by culture? Culture comprises the things that give us our humanity. Things like religion and art and philosophy, they give us our culture. They kind of make us the kind of people we are. The Bible does that for us. And so whether it's Judaism or Christianity or Islam or Buddhism, whatever it might be, the religion might be, that kind of gives a basis for how man approaches God. We talked the last couple of times, and this is back in your notes, and all the material I'm covering is, of course, in the booklet we have. I'm just simply presenting it in a way appropriate and from the pulpit. That I think is appropriate. We talked about religion a couple of weeks ago. We defined it as simply being the way that man approaches God. Whatever his or her conception of God might be, the whatever it is out there, and whether it's pantheistic or theistic or whatever kind of ism it might be, that when man reaches out to embrace whatever he sees as the greater one, and then studies his faith and his worship toward that whatever it might be, it's a very broad definition. That's a definition of religion. And it does fit Christianity and Judaism perfectly well, because we are concerned about the relationship to our Creator. We are concerned about how we approach Him in our faith and our worship and our service, and the Word of God is what makes that connection. We also talked about the distinction between God's religion and human religion as being basically that God's religion is based on revelation. He reveals to us all the knowledge that we need. From Genesis all the way down through Revelation, he gives us a story in as much as he wants to know us about our beginning and where we are going. And what God wants us to know, he's revealed to us. What he hasn't revealed, of course, we don't know, though we can still wonder about it. The opposite side is where Paul talks about in the first chapter of Romans, when man turns away from the Creator and decides to worship the creature, he then begins to make up his own religion, his own ideas. And that's where we are right now. When we come down to the Greek and ancient Roman religions, we're finding religions where men, turning away from God, then simply began to have their own ideas. And when you begin to worship the creature over the Creator, you worship whatever is created. And so whether they're worshiping men, we'll talk in a while about the worship of Caesar, the one who wanted to be God. Some of them wanted to be considered gods. Whether you're worshiping a man or an animal, animals were often avatars of gods. They would talk about the crocodile and the scarab beetle in Egyptian religion. They weren't really gods. They were avatars, which means that there were gods in the Egyptian or Greek religions, and these animals were considered to be representations of those gods. That's still just pure paganism. It's the inversion of Genesis 1:27. We mentioned this before. Genesis 1:27 said that God created man in his image. And of course, human religions just invert that, and man begins to make up God in his image. That's exactly what you get. So as we look at the Greek religion, which you've already done so far, and look at the Romans, who basically just simply took the Greek religion and adopted it to their own way, you're going to see that inversion where men then create gods and goddesses in their own image, and this is what we see. So bearing in mind those things we've talked about so far, we go on tonight to talk about ancient Roman religion. We've talked about the Greeks. We talked about their concept of heaven and hell, their idea of being lost and being saved in their own version of it, a far cry from Christianity. That was their way. When we turn and look at Roman religion, the advent of the Roman Empire, of course, brings about a whole new shift in everything in the world now. A new power has arisen before the power of Christ. The power of Christ as the ultimate kingdom, that will come during the Roman rule. That's why it's important to look at Roman culture, because it's during this human culture of the Romans that we'll see the birth of Christianity, the birth of Jesus Christ, and of course the birth of Christianity that occurs with his death and resurrection. So as we look at ancient Roman religion, and the key word is ancient there, because we go back as far as we can in history as it's relevant to our study and look at how it was going on there. If there are two ways you could distinguish Greek and Roman culture, history speaks of the Greco-Roman period. And they put the hyphen there because the Romans pretty much followed the Greek period. And the Greeks, if you could pick out two different words that might distinguish the Greek look at life or culture from the Roman, the Greek was more intellectual and philosophical, supposedly. And you turn to the Roman culture, it was much more pragmatic and much more kind of pragmatic or practical, very disciplined. The Romans' basic concern was not so much about religion, as we'll see, about gods and goddesses. They just kind of gave a cursory, reference to them, basically, but they wanted to use the gods and goddesses for political reasons, which I'll get into in a moment. So the distinction is you have this intellectual approach to life with Greek philosophy, of course, is born in ancient Greece, at least Western philosophy, and comes on down, where men are pondering the meaning of life, the purpose of life. We're also going to talk about that as it has its bearing on the New Testament as we go along. But the Romans came along and thought, kind of like that nonsense, at least the Roman elite thought, all we care about is pure power. And if the people want to have their religion and their beliefs, that's fine. So the Romans just simply adopted a whole lot of the Greek culture because they knew that the masses of people in the ancient world admired the Greek lifestyle. Most of them did. Alexander the Great certainly admired it. And so by taking the Greek language and the Greek art and literature and culture and spreading it, he was saying this was a great way of life. And the Romans would agree with that. But again, what became more important to the Romans was, again, political power. And so they kept the Greek culture to a certain extent and just simply renamed a whole lot of ideas or kind of rebranded it a certain way and kept it because it would appease and keep the people satisfied, but they went on. And so what happens is with all the Greek religion, if you look at Greek religion and Roman religion, if you study both of them historically, you will look at both of them and say, well, something? How come all of these Greek gods and goddesses are pretty much the same? I mean, the Romans, how come they're so similar to the Greek ones? Because the Greeks and the Roman emperors and leaders wanted to take the Greek religion, which was already pretty much established in society, and keep that because the people wanted that, the gods and goddesses, and rename them. So when you go through and look at all of the Greek names of the Greek gods and goddesses, the Romans came along and kept them pretty much, but rebranded them. And using the Latin language, because that was the official language of the Roman Empire, even though we've already said that, of course, Koine Greek became the universal language of the common people, but they maintained their Latin influence. And so they came along and took gods like Zeus, who was the primary god in the pantheon of gods in Olympus. Zeus would correspond to a Jehovah god in the sense of being, the prime god over all gods, and they renamed him Jupiter. And of course, then they come along and they took Artemis, of course, who was the goddess of childbearing and love, and named her Diana. We read about that in Ephesus. When they're shouting out, great as Diana, all they're doing is shouting out, great as Artemis, who was the Greek god who's now known as Diana. And Eros, our word erotic, comes from that. Eroticism, physical love. Eros is renamed Cupid, and we get our word concupiscence in the Bible. The word concupiscence does occur in the King James Bible, and it comes from Cupid also. And it conveys an ungodly kind of love. It's interesting also, when we talk about, and go back and read the etymology and the linguistic development of Greek, that in the Greek language there are three different words for love. And those three words, of course, phileo, brotherly love, and agape, which is godly love, and of course is storge, which is like family love. The one they leave out is eros. And people might say, why'd they leave out the word eros? It was a Greek word. It was physical love. It was a sexualized kind of love, and it was left out. And so I don't know, but I would imagine so as not to contaminate the very idea of love in the Bible with any kind of erotic love, they left that term out. So eros was another word, and then Cupid comes from that, concupiscence, of sexual love. And then Poseidon, of course, the god of the sea. We talked about that with animism, how that people would look at certain powers in the universe, like the ocean or the mountains that were bigger than we are, and they would begin to ascribe life to them. And then once they ascribe life to these, then they gave them, you know, powers like as gods and goddesses and gave them names. And so Poseidon became the, for the Greeks, he was the god of the sea, who controlled the sea. And of course the Romans simply renamed him Neptune, of course, is the Latin equivalent of that. But the point I want to make about it, when they came along and rebranded all these Greek gods and goddesses, they were still keeping them in the awareness of the Greek nations and the Greek people, the Greco-Roman people, to keep them happy. But Rome's point or emphasis, we said, was more political than religious. The Roman emperors didn't really care about religion because many of them didn't believe it. Many of them wanted, as we'll see as we go along, they wanted to aggrandize themselves. They were so arrogant and they had hubris. Hubris is the Greek word. Hubris in Greek religion was the worst sin you could commit. Hubris is elevating yourself to a god. We have our word hubris in the English language today. It comes from the word hubris in Greek, which means elevating oneself to a god or putting oneself to the point of having the power of a god or a goddess. It was the worst sin you could commit, and rightfully so, to call yourself a god. Domitian, who was the emperor, I'll mention this now, I think I said it before, Domitian was the emperor when John wrote Revelation on Patmos in about 96 AD. Domitian actually had his people, he commanded them to call him Lord and God. That is, he actually used the word Deus, which means call me God, and Dominus, which means Lord, Lord and Master. So there was a man actually saying, you are to call me your God and Master. That is supreme error. And again, I'm generalizing because there was, as we go on, we're going to find out there were some good emperors, like Constantine. There were good emperors, good because they were tolerant of Christianity and they were fairer. But there were some who were so arrogant, like Domitian and Caligula and Nero, that they just simply took themselves above and beyond this realm. But again, their focus was on politics. They wanted power, like many of our politicians today. They just want power. Whether it's good for the nation or good for the people, who cares? We want power. And so we will seize our power. We'll give the things the people that they want to make them happy, like what they called bread and circuses in ancient Rome. In ancient Rome, the expression bread and circuses meant that we'll give the people food to keep them fat and happy, and we'll give them circuses or, you know, races and hippodrome to kind of keep them entertained, to keep them useful idiots, as Stalin would call certain people. We'll just use them. And that was pretty much kind of the look that the emperors had on the people, that we use them as political pawns, as useful idiots, whatever you want to call them, for our purpose, but just keep them happy. And so for this emerging international power that is Rome, the Roman Empire, the primary function of religion was to serve the state and not any kind of celestial deities, which they didn't even believe. That sounds a lot like, if you read history, Marxism, because Marxism is based on the idea, of course, Marxism by definition is atheistic. If you ever hear someone call Marxism a form of Christianity or has a Christian element, then they haven't read the Communist Manifesto, that where Marx and Engels actually say there is no God. The state is the deity. And so there's a case where we can actually see in ancient history certain things that go along, nothing new under the sun, as Solomon said. So they wanted people to serve the state and only allow religion to exist as a palliative or, as Marx would say, like an opium for the people to kind of keep them drugged and keep them happy. We see it too, my second point going along about Roman religion is where we have emperor, high priest, and pope, the beginning of the pope. Rome's first emperor, of course, was Augustus Caesar, who reigned from 27 BC to 14 AD. He was the emperor who ruled at the time of the birth of Christ. And what's interesting is he got so caught up in his self-aggrandizement, his sense of self-importance, that he even assumed the title of Pontifex Maximus, which is Latin for high priest. And so even the Roman emperors could see that the people, whether they were Jews or Christians, they had this idea of a high priest. There was a high priest in Judaism. And of course, Christ is called the high priest in the book of Hebrews. So he is our high priest with a capital H and a capital P. They saw that and thought they wanted to kind of tag into that. And so the idea is that the Roman emperors begin to realize that we might be able to take certain kinds of religious concepts like an emperor, like a pope, a you know, a Lord and a God and turn it to our own benefit. And so this is what was seen in history. It's the beginning of Caesaropapism. You see the word Caesar there and the word papism, which pope meaning father. And that particular Latin term just means Caesar as pope. And we're not going to go into it in this class. It's a different class altogether. You look historically at the emergence of the Roman Catholic Church, you see certain similarities where one merges into the other, where, you know, the church also becomes politically oriented as the empire already was, and they grow that way. So from this alone, from this Caesaropapism, that is the Caesar as pope, you see the beginning of the emergence of the Roman Catholic, what will be the Roman Catholic, well, you see the Roman Empire beginning to merge with a certain kind of religion of a high priest coming together, and that will be the focus and beginning of what's known as the Roman Catholic Church, where they begin to mirror each other's hierarchy. And if you look at the hierarchy of the Roman Catholic Church and the hierarchy of the early Empire of Rome, you will see a similarity in their structure. And it wasn't just a coincidence that occurred. But again, that's a whole different lesson, but you might want to bear it in mind as far as historical significance. A third point we want to make, and again, this is all in your booklet, but I'm just trying to bring it out in maybe a different way here. So enamored they were, these emperors, by their self-importance, some emperors began to put more importance on their political leaders than they did their traditional gods and goddesses. So I mentioned a while ago that some of the emperors actually wanted to keep the people happy and kind of keep them, you know, kind of in a palliative condition where they're just kind of, you know, doing their religion. But some of the emperors became so arrogant, they just got to a point where they thought, forget that. You know, we're not even going to worry about that now. We are God. And certain people like Nero, Caligula, Domitian, and a few others, and even to a certain extent, well, Augustus, the first emperor, begin to go to their heads in the sense of like thinking, we are now the state. We are greater than the state. We are even above the state because we are like gods and goddesses, where Domitian said that you will now recognize me as Lord and Master. That is the ultimate blasphemy for a man to call himself Lord and God and take full credit. But this began to happen. And where they didn't even care that much. And in a book, one of my books in my library called Life in Ancient Rome, a really good book about the whole history of ancient Roman history, one historian says, and this is a quote that I to which I made a reference earlier, by the end of the Republic in 27 BC, the Republic ended. Julius Caesar tried to become the first emperor. Because of that, he was assassinated on March 15th in 44 BC in the capital there by others, including his best friend, Et tu Brute, my best friend stabbing me. By that time, when he died, the Roman government was in chaos. And there was a great civil war going on involving Antony and Cleopatra and Octavius Caesar and others, Pompey coming together. And when all the dust settled, so to speak, and all the wars were over in 27 BC, some years later, then finally the Republic ended. And that was the beginning of what becomes the Roman Empire. But what's interesting is, as time went on, there were fewer and fewer educated Romans. We're going to talk about education coming up next, about what was education like in ancient Greece and Rome. How were people educated? There were many educated Romans, as we are educated people here. An educated people just means a thinking person. It means a person who asks questions. I'm not talking about your degree of formal education. All it means is if you are a thinking person who asks questions, like the Bereans in Acts 17:11, if you simply ask questions, you don't just take what you're told, what you're given and take it, you check the word of God, you ask questions, that's a form of critical thinking. You begin to reason and ask questions. But some of the ancient Romans, and I want to make a comment later on about ancient Romans, they weren't as ancient as we thought. They were people just like us, so we'll talk about that later. They were just rigged. But by the end of the Republic, in the early days of the Empire, when the Empire first started to grow, few educated Romans, the historian says, seem to have retained any genuine belief in the existence of the gods. So when I was talking about the gods and the goddesses and all their crazy goings on in Mount Olympus or in the heavens, out of the mythology, people in the audience, you were smiling and laughing. That's crazy. Well, there were many ancient Romans who began to think the same thing. This is crazy nonsense. There are no gods and goddesses. And even though they might give them a cursory or a nominal acknowledgement, like, okay, we'll say they're there, they really didn't believe. And of course, once you get people really no longer believing in a religion, of course, the religion is going to eventually collapse. And so what happened, though, as far as the empire itself, religion then increasingly takes a back seat in Roman life not as something where you're honoring any kinds of, you know, beings out there, but political expediency. And if you've read your history very well and read about Niccolo Machiavelli, who back in the period he wrote, Middle Ages into the Renaissance, when you hear the word Machiavelli, it's all about political expediency. But all that matters is keeping the people fearful of you and keep them in their place, and they will use fear that way. The Roman Empire actually is really kind of a early avatar for what became the Machiavellian idea, which then in later times becomes basically Marxism today. You just kind of keep people where they belong. You can give them a dose of their little religion there to keep them happy, but you have power and you keep your foot on their neck, so to speak. And that's exactly what Rome began to do. And of course, with the advent of Christianity, Galatians 4:4, when Christ was sent by his Father, when that happens, all the more then, as Christianity, of course, ran against the Roman Empire in the sense of, you know, not acknowledging that the emperor is God, that made the Christians more and more subject to the persecution, which began to increase as time went on. My fourth point is that Rome now, and by Rome I mean the whole Roman Empire, Rome now, involved with political ambition more than anything else, they saw religion as a system, as a way to accommodate the masses, to kind of keep them happy, and more so than serving a spiritual purpose. So for the Romans, if there was any kind of element of religion in their system, whether it was allowing Christianity or whether it was giving paganism, it was simply to keep the people happy, because we have higher aims, that is to carry on with the empire and to increase our power. So the difference between Greek and Roman gods, as we make this distinction, we talked about the Greek gods earlier in the last couple of weeks, now we're going on to Roman religion. The basic distinction was that between Greek and Roman gods was more cosmetic than cosmic. But what I mean by that is cosmetic, it was only the appearance of Christianity that mattered to the Roman Empire. As long as the people obey us and do what we say and don't bother us, we'll let them practice their Christianity. When they have a conflict with us, of course, we'll come down on them as they did. So it was all about the cosmetics of just religion as it looked to the people. And it wasn't cosmic. That is, it has no significance of being about a true God in the universe there. So Rome became more increasingly nominal in their allowance of religion. And one particular writer in my studies actually pointed out, as I've got on the screen here, that the pantheon, that is the collection of the ancient Roman gods, was largely adopted from that of other civilizations. So Rome was pretty much a copycat in that sense. Even though they did expand their own power by their own strength and their discipline, they basically took certain kinds of cultural ideas like religion and literature and copied a lot of it. Now, that's not to say, I'm going to be a fair teacher here, not to say Romans didn't have their culture. They had Cicero, they had all kinds of great, you know, philosophers and writers in their time, but their overall concern was, getting my screen back, there it is, okay. Their overall concern was, of course, to carry on their practical religion. And as the Greek deities had done, the Roman gods lived, loved, and fought their battles in a way that mirrored the lives of mortals. So as you see the Greeks with their gods and the Romans as well, when you study Greek religion and mythology, you will see again, coming back to Romans 1 now, bring it all back to it, that the gods and goddesses that you read about in Greek religion, Greek mythology, they fought, they committed adultery, they cheated, they lied, they had civil wars in heaven. You think that sounds like humans. Well, yeah, duh. I mean, the people who actually made up the Roman religion were writing it from their own imagination, Romans 1, 25. And so as a result of that, what you're going to see in Greek and Roman religion is simply a mirroring of what occurred, of course, out of man's mind. And this will be a good place, I think I'll have time to finish off here. My fifth point on this particular topic, I like to show examples of where there's an incursion in the New Testament out of what we're talking about here. You might say, well, where does this ever show up in the Bible? Well, it does. This is history that's going on. And so whenever something occurs in history, you know, around you, you can never be unscathed by what's going on. This clash of paganism we've been talking about with Christianity occurs in Asia Minor, modern-day Turkey, as a local citizens. There were some local citizens who were steeped in Roman religion. They believed, at least supposedly, in the gods and goddesses of ancient Rome. They believed in gods, you know, like Jupiter and Mercury, whom they will mention here. And it is in Acts 14, 11 through 15. I'm just going to summarize and paraphrase that section. In Acts 14, 11 through 15, we read an instance where the Paul and Barnabas are out teaching and preaching, and they're performing miracles. Now, the people who believe in the Greek gods or the Roman gods, they see these miracles and think, wow, that is truly the work of a supernatural being. They see miracles which they can't explain by their own Roman religion. They see them and think, this is something that's greater. Now, rather than praising Jehovah God, because these are pagans, they go to the next best thing, which is they have as the Roman gods. And what they do, they see Paul, who's the speaker, and they call him Mercury. Mercury, whose Greek name was Hermes, who is the messenger of the gods. They saw him as the speaker and thought, well, he's speaking the most, so he must be Mercury. They, you know, and I guess they perceived Barnabas as a leader, and they called him Jupiter. So when they yell out and say to these, it's in verse, I think it's verse 15 or 14, that, these gods have come down. The gods have come down, these Roman gods. And of course, this raises the ire of the apostles because they are so angry about this because they realize, no. Don't ascribe this to your silly Roman gods. They didn't say that, but I'm sure they thought that. This is the power of the true living God, the one of which Paul speaks in Mars Hill in Acts 17. And that being the case now, these people who are steeped in that religion, they call out and say, oh, Barnabas is Jupiter and Paul is Mercury. And of course, the apostles rebuke them completely. And it's interesting also, because this moment, just like on the Areopagus, Mars Hill, this is a great moment for Paul and Barnabas to come out and preach the gospel. Perfect opportunity here, because they realize now this is the time to come out and say, no, we are not gods at all. This is Jehovah God. They can now turn the people's attention to the true God who's causing this miracle that we're doing through the power that we have. And so he calls them out on that. So there's a case, and of course I also mentioned on Mars Hill in Acts 17, 23 through 25, Paul does the same thing there. He sees the Roman people. He says, I see that you are religious. Like here he would have said, I see that you believe in Jupiter and Mercury. That's fine that you believe in something out there, but you've got the total wrong idea. What is out there is Jehovah God. And so Paul and Barnabas take advantage of these two situations where we see pagan culture and religion clash with Christianity and turn it into a moment of God. And I want to mention one last, I think I'll have enough time to mention this, one last note before we go on here, insert this, the positive influence of Judaism. We talked about this earlier. When we were studying Judaism in the intertestamental period between Malachi and Matthew in that period, we saw that Judaism had certain advantages that was helping out with. And one of the advantages of Judaism, even though it rejected Jesus, many of them did, which is, you know, the wrong thing. One good thing was, during this period of the 300 or 400 years between the Testaments, there was hope of a messianic figure. That is, the Old Testament did point to a messianic figure. Many Jews mistook it the wrong way, like, oh, it'll be like a king like David. Of course, they misunderstood, they misapplied it. But it still prepared them for somebody who is coming. Some one king is coming to save us, you know, to bring us back. And even though they were thinking of him as a political, military leader, the point was it was kind of making the hearts ready for some personal being to come along. So in a certain sense, Judaism, with its focus on an earthly king, still brought the attention to a savior, which was totally foreign to Greek and Roman religions. There was no savior in Greek and Roman religions. There was no kind of salvation. And so Judaism actually does, if it does nothing else, it does that to kind of prepare people's hearts and mind. So when John the Baptist came along, he could say the time is now, the one is come, you know, so he can prepare the people for that way. So this was, the Old Testament king was based on a Davidic, that is an earthly kingdom based in the likeness of David, but still a glorious future of hope and salvation had been planted in the hearts of the people, and it might help them be more receptive if they're honest that when Jesus finally comes, he's the real king, obey him. Thank you for your attention this evening.